I guess it's ironic that it's the home of the free speech movement, but no, in any public space, American citizens have constitutional rights. And just note, I've never been shut down from speaking anywhere in this country.
Conservative provocateur Ann Coulter on Fox News last night. She's talking about UC Berkeley attempting to reschedule a speech she had planned to give next week to the following week. The university fears violent protests, which have become a regular fixture there since the election of Donald Trump. We'll talk about that coming up. First, France. There was another terrorist attack in Paris yesterday. A police officer was killed. Two other officers were wounded, and the shooter was killed. Officials are calling the attack terrorism. There have been more than half a dozen terrorist attacks in France over the past 2 years. There was last year's Bastille Day attack in Nice, where a truck ran into a crowd, killing 86 people. In 2015 in Paris, terrorists with bombs and assault rifles targeted the National Stadium, cafes, and the Bataclan Concert Hall. 130 people died then. Also that year, there was the shootout at the Charlie Hebdo offices where 17 people died. Here to help us understand the situation in France is Farah Pandith, an adjunct senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. She's also a former special representative to Muslim communities for the U.S. Department of State, the State Department. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Well, what is it about France? It seems that there have been many terrorist attacks in France in a short period of time recently. Is France a special case when it comes to terrorist attacks in Europe?
I think it's important that we pull out the question a little bit more broadly than France to understand that in Europe, when we look at what is taking place in terms of the radicalization of young people, it is not in a vacuum. And this ideology that extremist groups like ISIS put forward in terms of an us and them and wanting to demonstrate that they are pretending to be sort of the best type of Muslim is the ideology that that they use to lure young people across Europe. And France has the largest population of Muslims anywhere in Europe, and it is complicated to suggest that it is because of France that there's something peculiar there that is happening that is different. What we absolutely must look at across Europe is the dimensions around the generation of young people that we're talking about that are lured into the extremists' clutches, as well as whether or not the narrative story of where these extremists, where the country thinks about themselves vis-a-vis immigrants and who they are in terms of identity, has to do with being a colonizer or not being a colonizer. So,
right.
Madeline, when you ask this question, I think it's important to look at both of those dimensions and then take a look at France and say, what's happening here? Because we absolutely know that the issue of identity and the issue of belonging is central to the issue of how a young person thinks about themselves and why they might find this ideology appealing.
Okay, so you mentioned the colonial legacy. France, of course, was a colonizer in Northern Africa and still deals with the legacy of that brutal period. And identity and belonging, you mentioned. So how does France handle that when it comes to creating an identity and a sense of belonging for people of North African descent? And how does that differ from other European countries?
Well, France is a very unique country on many levels, including the fact that, you know, the idea of what it means to be French has a lot to do with laïcité, and how they think about religion is not connected in a way that other European countries actually define themselves. So it is unique in that way, and it is unique in the sense of their sense of what it means to be French has been really talked about and defined over the course of the last 16 years in a very particular way in the post 9/11 world, because we have, as a globe, been having these conversations around what's happening with young people globally that are finding appeal in the ideology of an Al Qaeda or an ISIS now today. We have seen countries that have said, "Who are we? And how do we define ourselves? And what does it mean to be French? What does it mean to be Spanish? What does it mean to be British?" As we are here in America talking about what it means to be be American. What's interesting about France, you know, the New York Times in 2015 describes a darker mood toward Islam, unquote, as they describe what's happening within the country of France. And I think this issue of fear and this issue of who we are is intersecting for the experience of these young Muslims growing up. And so whether you are a first-generation French person of Muslim origin or you have been in France for many generations, there is a different feeling, Madeline, right mm-hmm. now about being Muslim in France. And I think many of your listeners will also agree that that conversation, that is not particular to France, that's a question that's been happening all over the world, including our own country.
Yeah. Well, are there countries in Europe who are doing a better job in making the mood less dark in terms of its attitude towards Islam? I know, you know, Angela Merkel in Germany has been struggling with that, but there are also fears there in Germany and terrorist attacks in Germany. So is France, how is it handling it in a different way than other countries, or is it not? Is it just a question of degree?
So I think it is important to understand also that there is a symbolic and emotional signal that happens when people are living their lives in communities. It isn't just about what's happening at the top level coming down. It's not just about what law enforcement may or may not be doing. It's not just about whether or not a country has opened their doors to immigrants or not. It is about what it feels like mm-hmm. to grow up being mm-hmm. Muslim in these spaces. And in the case of that where you're asking, you know, is there something in particular that's happening in Germany that's different than France, one could look at particular, decisions that are being made around identity and belonging. Are you allowed to pray freely? Are you allowed to dress freely? Are you allowed to all these things that we think have to do with the way a person feels about themselves? But you have to go deeper than that, and you have to think about the experience of living globally right now with an us and them narrative, with the idea of being Muslim front and center on everyone's mind, whether you are a Muslim or you're not a Muslim. That is the feeling. That is the mood, if you will, the ecosystem in which people are living.
Yeah.
And I think that the question you ask about the degree, I would say that in France there's been an uptick in the last few years, not just because of the fear factor and the many attacks, as you describe them, and there are, some very significant and very serious differences in France in terms of the amount of life loss, the amount of fear that's happening in communities, whether it's a priest that has been attacked or a police officer. I mean, there are some serious things that have happened in France. But the question you should be asking also is, if you have a country like France that has such a really great intel service that is monitoring what is happening really well, why isn't that translating to what's happening at the community level and what's happening with regard to the trust that happens between communities and the law enforcement, so that you are seeing the warning signs earlier on and that you are working very hard, not just on the kinetic side or the law enforcement side or the hard power side, but you're also working to stop the appeal of the ideology within your community, the so-called recruitment
the
piece,
and
or the so-called
part.
Soft power.
Yeah, and so when, after the Bataclan attacks, that horrific multiple attacks in Paris, then there was that crackdown and martial law, pretty much. And so I wonder if that, you know, worked across purposes, because then that cut off maybe people who were willing to cooperate with law enforcement, but then were...
Well, the trust, you're speaking about the issue of trust, and you're right when you say one would want to do as many things to open up the opportunity to have a connectivity between community and law enforcement. But I would make the larger point, which is if countries haven't invested in the work of stopping the appeal of the ideology, you will consistently see an increase in attacks all over the world, not just in France, because the extremist groups haven't stopped their efforts to recruit. What we must do as citizens and as government is to scale up proportionally our ability to put in counter-narratives and alternative narratives to the narrative of the extremists, so that you will not see that appeal and you won't see the movement towards violence.
Farah Pandeth, adjunct senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And if you're a part of the French community here or abroad, what kinds of conversations are you having about terrorism in France? What have you thought about the recent terrorist attacks over the past few years? You can give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can weigh in on our Facebook page at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, the busing experiment in Los Angeles fizzled after a few years in the 1970s. It was aimed at desegregating the public schools. But for two men now in their 50s, that busing experiment changed their lives. Their story is next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
This was a slope, remember?
Exactly. This was a slope, and there was a corner of the yard where we used to go when we wanted a little privacy,
some of us. That's right.
On the playground at the Wonderland Elementary School in Laurel Canyon, two guys, Stephen Frank and Kevi Rogers, they're in their 50s now, are remembering third grade.
That's when I saw Dina Sudman.
Dina Sudman.
Dana Friedman.
Oh, yes.
They were all smoking.
Girls. They were smoking.
And I'm like, you guys are smoking in elementary school?
It was 1972. More people smoked back then. And Los Angeles was trying to fix its schools. They were segregated. The education was so unequal, an L.A. judge said the district was violating children's constitutional rights. The city's solution was controversial: busing, taking kids out of their districts to integrate the schools citywide. Only 2 years earlier, Governor Ronald Reagan had signed a bill outlawing mandatory busing in California.
Governor Ronald Reagan set the stage today for another court test in California of busing to achieve school integration. He signed a bill to outlaw busing without the consent of the parents of each student.
Judicial rulings intended to force compulsory busing on parents and families against their wishes and without their consent have distressed the vast majority of our citizens who strongly oppose racial discrimination, but who understandably view mandatory busing as a ridiculous waste of time and public money, which could seriously undermine all efforts to improve the quality of our public schools.
But in 1971, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that busing could be used to integrate schools. And a year later, Los Angeles launched a voluntary program. And one of the first kids to volunteer was Kevi Rogers. He would get on a bus every morning in his South Central neighborhood. And about an hour and a half later, he'd get off the bus in the Hollywood Hills.
I was distracted initially, but my thinking expanded of what I could be, of what there was out there, because I saw the Brady Bunch growing up. You know, that's what I watched. And I was like, oh, that's white world. That's white world on the Brady Bunch. It's not real. Being bused was like, wow, this is the Brady Bunch in real life. And I saw the homes and I saw the cars, and I'm a big car fan. And I was like, what does it take to get that?
Stephen Frank was one of the white kids who lived near Wonderland in Laurel Canyon.
I would say that on our end of that experience, it was at first more of the surprise of people who really didn't look like us and who didn't live like us, and we were aware of that. You know, we grew up very privileged in this canyon.
We're the fifth graders.
Today, it's still a privileged place, maybe even more so. Stephen and Kevi are back at Wonderland because Stephen has written a children's book based on his friendship with Kevi and the busing experience.
Hi, everyone. Today, we have a very special guest for you. Ethan and I were lucky enough to interview him for the Coyote Howler a few weeks ago, as well as read his awesome...
The book is called Armstrong and Charlie.
A story about how two friends from different worlds become best friends.
So kids, Becca and I are proud to introduce Stephen Frank.
Thank you, Becca and Ethan. That was so nice of you. Bye, guys. It is great to be back here at Wonderland. Thank you, Mr. Tier.
And then Stephen read from his book.
What's the name of this school, I ask? Wonderland. Wonderland? You're sending me to a school called Wonderland? Well, I'm not going, I say, arms locked across my chest. You got to be firm with people, especially parents.
There aren't many black faces in the audience. It's mostly white and Asian kids.
Wonderland is it's a gifted magnet, and so you have the homeschool, population of kids who draws from Laurel Canyon here. And then you have the other is the magnet drawn primarily from Koreatown. And the magnet system today is, in a sense, the legacy of the opportunity busing that Permits with Transportation program that you came on.
Mm-hmm. When Stephen pulls out class photos from back then, it looks pretty white.
If you look at after the integration order, this is 1974, and here there's a little bit more color in the class picture. But in this picture, the only two students who were bused in are Keevy here and Charlie Campbell over here. In the book, he's a character named Otis. We also had Hollywood kids in the canyon. This is Radon Chong.
No,
that's
Robbie.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, that's Robbie Chong. And who else was up here?
Carol King's daughter.
Louise Goffin was here, and Sherry Goffin. Those were the daughters of Carol King.
So this is the first year that, Keevy, you came to Wonderland?
This is the second year, right? What is this, Mr. Michael's class? Or
no, it's Miss Wingate.
No, this was the second year then.
Yeah.
But how did you feel in general? Because even though there are two other black kids in your class there, you guys are in the minority.
That's the beautiful thing, I think, about being a child. You don't focus so much on that. The shocker came at the beginning of busing, and that was the first year. And then kids just want to be kids. The politics and stuff come from the adults. So once we got together and we integrated, then we just basically just started sharing what we do, new games, new experiences and stuff like that, and then we were just kids. So I never thought about that. I never thought I was black and they were a bunch of white kids. Never thought about it. We fought and whatever, stuff like that, and bullying was going on, but it always seemed to work itself out to where it didn't get too far out of hand. Because I look at some of these kids, and I think about Todd Euler called me the N-word, and I kicked his ass. That was it. It never, nothing, no office, no. It never happened again.
But there were other moments, like when a teacher played My Old Kentucky Home in the classroom.
The sun shines bright in the old Kentucky home.
It's kind of hard to hear, but the song goes, "'Tis summer, the darkies are gay." Gay as in happy. But darkies, the whole song is a lament for the good old antebellum days.
The time has come when the darkies have to part.
To the white kids sitting in the room, and here we have black children in the room, and he's playing a song that is about slavery, but calls the black people darkies, was like, what is he doing that?
So how did you feel in that moment?
Well, I remember distinctly feeling extremely uncomfortable and not wanting to sing. And then...
Because there were black kids in the classroom?
Yes.
And how did you feel in that moment?
Didn't think one way or another, singing a song. And I didn't even remember the darkie line. That's the funny thing about it. That was fourth grade. I was still adjusting to being overwhelmed by the change of environment. I don't know if I would have even put darkie together what it was referring to.
Keevy and Stephen didn't know why the teacher played that song. But the fact was, not everyone was thrilled about busing. It was one thing for it to be voluntary. But a few years later, in 1978, it became mandatory, and that meant white kids would also have to get on buses. Their parents were outraged. A mom in Encino, Bobby Fiedler, she organized a group of moms to protest.
I had two children and had just been divorced, and they were going to elementary school, and they started talking about the possibility of busing. I got involved vocally on the subject. Although I'd never been a public speaker, I learned to do it out of necessity. And we had a number of meetings, and we decided to, there were about a half a dozen of us with a core group, and we decided to go ahead and fight it.
Her group was called Bus Stop, and it grew fast to 30,000 members. They were able to get the mandatory busing program shut down after just 3 years.
Mandatory busing was ordered by the courts and heralded as the only way to integrate Los Angeles schools. But now, a month after it began in earnest, educators, parents, and teachers generally agree it has failed. Not because of the demonstrations that have, on a few occasions, stopped the buses from rolling. Not because of the protests. Not because of violence between the races. There hasn't been any. Busing has failed because the number of white students needed to make it work have quietly dropped out of the public schools. One-fourth of the whites scheduled for the rides do not show up.
And so the district changed their plans and made it an entirely voluntary program. And that's what we have today, the magnet school choices. You get the packet. But even that, you have to know your way around the system in order to figure out which school to get into and how you get those points. It's not so simple. And I think the result is we still have a lot of segregation.
On the strength of her anti-busing campaign, Bobby Fiedler went on to become a member of Congress in the 1980s. Now she lives in Northridge, and she says she doesn't have any regrets.
I really didn't have any option but to try to protect my kids. That was my biggest interest, not putting them on a bus. I was a working mother at that time, and I wouldn't have done anything different. And nobody can tell me that putting a child who happens to be a different skin color on a bus and making them spend 2 hours getting to Chatsworth Elementary School from South Central is sensible, either for the child or for the family. It never was racial for me.
For Stephen and Kivi, that brief experiment changed them forever. Kivi says that long bus ride, that hour and a half each way, it wasn't a big deal.
What was it like for you going home on the bus every day?
Going home on the bus, that was fine. The bus ride became fun because we had a lot of fun. We used to sing on the bus and do all types. When we got home, that's when reality sets back in. And you didn't play outside like you used to. It used to be when the news vans or whatever reporters would come in because of something that happened in the neighborhood. Everybody wants to run and jump behind and get on camera. That changed to where I would avoid that at all costs because I didn't want my friends who went to school here to see me in that environment. Wow, Kivi lives over there. Now I'm more or less embarrassed of that existence. That's what that brought out.
In a strange way, I felt embarrassed about how we lived here. And I think that one of the impediments to building a real-life friendship with some of these kids is that we felt very self-conscious. I felt very self-conscious about having kids who were not of privilege come into my home. And we grew up here in the canyon, and I was a member of the tennis club. And I just didn't want them to see all that.
Stephen and Kivi lost touch after middle school. Kivi went on to Hollywood High and college. He's now a stand-up comedian, and he lives in the mainly white city of Santa Clarita. He got married and had kids. Stephen went to Fairfax High and also to college, and he also got married and had kids. He's now a middle school English teacher.
I did know that Kivi had been a stand-up comedian, and actually one day years ago, the LA Times landed on my front porch. And opened up the calendar section, and there was Kivi. He had won the Aspen Young Comics Festival. And then my mom, who's a big late-night television, she goes back to Johnny Carson, she told me, oh, I think Kivi's going to be on the Jay Leno show. So we went and saw him on TV, and he was so funny. And I was like, I can't believe it. That's Kivi? That's that kid who's got the scowl on his face in the school picture? And he was just so funny.
Stephen still lives near Wonderland. He says over the years, he would think of Kivi often. Kivi had a big impact on him. It's why he wanted to write the book.
And once the book was done, I sent it in. I said, okay, when we get an advanced copy of this book, I want to send it to Kivi's the first person. So I tracked him down, and I sent him the book. And we had breakfast together, and we talked for hours and hours. But I wanted to wait, and I'm so glad I did, because now, you know, the book is the book, and the friendship is here, and this goes forward in life. And I'm so thrilled that he has been so successful coming out of Wonderland, and it's a bond that we'll always have, this school.
It's late in the afternoon now. Stephen signs copies of his book for the kids at Wonderland. And then Kivi and Stephen go outside. They walk together to Stephen's house. Stephen Frank's book is called Armstrong and Charlie, and he'll be appearing at the LA Times Book Festival this Sunday at 11 a.m. Coming up, it is movie time. We'll have reviews of the new releases, including Unforgettable, starring Katherine Heigl and Rosario Dawson.
I don't want to invoke the holy name of Obsessed, starring Beyoncé and Ali Larter, but this is a similar plot. It is as trashy and as silly. Not as good, but still wildly entertaining.
Plus, a lush costume drama, a shoot-'em-up, and a celebrity chef documentary. That's all next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. For those of you not overheating and dehydrating, watching your favorite music artist perform in the desert this weekend, how about a relaxing trip to the movies? Air conditioning. Yes, it's Friday. Time to talk about new releases. Dave White, Alonso Duralde are here. They both review For the Wrap, and they both host Linoleum Knife Podcast. And they're both sitting in front of me now.
Hello.
Hi.
Howdy.
But only one of you saw Unforgettable.
The lucky one.
The lucky one.
That's
okay,
me.
So this is a thriller starring Katherine Heigl and Rosario Dawson, and here's a clip.
I only had David and Lily. You took everything away from me.
Who sent you flowers?
What do you mean there's no record of who sent the arrangement?
Take a deep breath. No one knows where you live.
Where's your ring? How come you haven't been wearing it?
She's messing with me.
I made one mistake.
There isn't a day that goes by that...
Tessa. Goodbye.
Okay, so Tessa is Katherine Heigl.
Oh, yes.
She's the spurned ex-wife.
Mm-hmm.
The new wife is Rosario Dawson. And?
She's a disappointment.
To?
Everyone. It's a motherhood. And Katherine Heigl, Tessa, understands this, and she sets about to correct the problem.
I see.
Yes.
With
why she does this is a little shaky, because the man that she wants back is... He's a block of wood. There's
Who is
nothing.
He?
An actor named Jeff Stoltz. Sorry, Jeff Stoltz, if you're listening, but I don't know you. But Katherine Heigl, obsessed with him, and she will do whatever it takes. And whatever it takes involves stalking Rosario Dawson, polishing silver with barely contained fury.
Does she smoke? Because villains always
smoke. Oh, no. Oh, even better. She vapes.
That's how you know she's evil.
With an evil flair. Now, all right. There's a long history of films like this about unhinged, deranged women.
Fighting for a man.
Fighting for a guy who's barely
disrupting
worth.
Disrupting domestic tranquility.
The guy's barely worth the effort, but she's going to get it. Okay. And these movies play fast and loose and extremely carelessly with the subject of mental illness. And if that bothers you, don't go see these kinds of movies. And I don't want to invoke the holy name of Obsessed, starring Beyoncé and Ali Larter, but this is a similar plot. It is as trashy and as silly, not as good, but still wildly entertaining. And that is all because of Katherine Heigl, who has had, to this point, a career where she is trapped in a box of niceness.
Hmm.
And I think people are tired of it. And I think she's tired of it. She was in a terrible little movie a couple years ago called The Big Wedding that nobody went to see.
Yeah.
She was the memorable thing about that film, because she just walked through that movie throwing out cruel, sarcastic one-liners at every other person in the cast. And I remember watching it thinking, you I like. This movie's garbage, but you're great.
So obviously someone else had the same thought.
And she's great here, too. She's got that Mary Tyler Moore and Ordinary People stare. That Why are you putting that glass on the table when you know that it will leave a ring?
Icy blonde.
Why are you such a problem for me? You must be eradicated. And that is what she sets about to do. And she does it with the fury. And she's fantastic. This movie is dumb. But I had a blast, and it's all because of her. I am now Team Katherine Heigl for life. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, some things can change.
Some performers just need to be freed from the shackles of likability.
Mm. Yeah. You remember Tom Cruise in Collateral? Finally, he was a villain. and you thought, wow, I'm not bored by Tom Cruise
Magnolia
anymore.
Magnolia, too.
Yeah.
I like Tom Cruise when I don't have to like Tom Cruise.
Yeah. Okay. Up next, Free Fire. This takes place in the 1970s. Two gangs meet up to make a transaction in a Boston warehouse. Here's a clip.
Check out the merch.
That's not what he ordered.
Really?
We ordered M16s, different weapon.
I'm not running a f***ing pizza delivery service.
Keep your together.
You want the weapons or you don't want the weapons?
Oh, I've already calmed the f*** down!
Here we go. Oh, now we're cooking!
All right, so I watched the trailer for this. It seemed like all they were doing was shooting at each other. Like, is this just the third act, the entire movie?
No, the whole thing is them shooting each
right,
other.
Right, so it's only the third act for the entire 2 hours.
Basically, yeah. It's basically like, yes. It's sort of like when you let a group of 8-year-old boys loose in a warehouse and they just go bang, 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 bang at each other for 90 minutes. I admire what this movie is trying to do because, yeah, it is essentially the entire thing is this enclosed space. Everyone's got a gun. Everyone's hiding behind a box or a girder or something, and they're all shooting at each other for various reasons. And, you know, there are alliances that shift, and there are people who are trying to get out, and people are getting wounded and staggering around because they've got a bullet in their knee or their shoulder or whatever. So on paper, yes, cool idea. What's a director going to do to make this set of limitations exciting and interesting? And it's Ben Wheatley, who is a British filmmaker who has a cult following that I am not part of. And
I'm kind of a part of it.
This is
in England. And this Kill List.
This is my cool third, movies. The third movie of his that I've seen. I don't care for his work, and I don't think that this one really comes off the way that he wants it to, because the whole notion of a bunch of people shooting each other in an enclosed space requires very specific editing and cinematography requirements. You need to know where people are in relation to each other. You need to be able to discern one character from another, which gets harder to do when everybody starts getting covered in viscera and dirt, except for Armie Hammer, who is impeccable throughout, and that's part of the joke. Also, it would help if you gave a rat's behind that any of them survive. And frankly, if the warehouse... It's radio. I don't know what I can say. If the warehouse exploded, taking out every single character, I would have not cared a whit. And so I'm not saying that, oh, there need to be somebody likable or whatever. But if I'm not rooting for anybody, I don't have a vested interest in this person getting away and this person not getting away. It just is literally 90 minutes of blam, 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 blam. And I got very bored very quickly.
Okay, so we're going to move on because we have a lot to go through.
It was a little better than that in terms of how much fun it is to watch people get killed. But unfortunately, it bears so much resemblance to Reservoir Dogs.
Yes.
And the wave of Reservoir Dogs-like films that followed it.
Can we just say that was a long time ago?
That was a long time ago, and this just
It took me back to being a film festival programmer in the mid-90s and seeing all the post-Pulp Fiction movies doing that exact thing.
Yeah.
Okay, now for something that is the complete and total opposite, a costume drama about poet Emily Dickinson, played by Cynthia Nixon, directed by Terrence Davies. Here's a clip from A Quiet Passion.
You may marry.
Ladies.
I think not.
Your soul is no trivial matter.
I agree, Father. That's why I'm so meticulous in guarding its independence.
And you, Miss Dickinson, will you not kneel and give yourself to God?
I will not kneel.
How dare you conduct yourself in such a manner?
Oh, I love it.
What I love about that clip is that there's more music and talking and noise in that 30 seconds than there is, I think, maybe in the entire film.
So you've got the costumes.
The
you've
quiet.
Got the,
they've got it nailed.
You've got the violins. You've got the woman constrained by the social mores of the time. Go.
Well. Constrained by the social mores of the time, but really living on her own terms, mm-hmm. that Emily Dickinson. She was, if nothing, a master of refusal. She was very strong-willed, and she was determined to think for herself, to do as she pleased, to work as she wanted to work, and to do it in a sort of voluntary cloister. She didn't leave her town, her block, her house. Her world got smaller and smaller as she got older, and she didn't live very long. And that kind of life is perfect for a filmmaker like Terrence Davies, whose attention to space is always so palpable, and you can feel it. Long, slow shots that draw you into the environment that the person is living out their story in, and very often a kind of melancholy in his mm-hmm. films. And Emily Dickinson did not, in spite of the fact that she was, again, determined not to let anyone tell her what to do, it wasn't always a happy life. You can feel her butting up against this highly structured existence that she's built for herself. And it becomes a story that is kind of a tragedy, but it also understands that her tragedy might have actually contributed to this work that we now know. Nixon's performance is, I don't use this word very often, magnificent. She deserves whatever accolades come her way, end of the year. It's truly beautiful. It's full of empathy and sorrow.
And Terrence Davies, he has this ability to really capture complicated women.
Yes.
So there was Rachel Weisz in The Deep Blue Sea, Gillian Anderson in The House of Mirth.
Yes.
That Edith Wharton novel.
Yeah. In my opinion, he is England's greatest director. And he's 70 now. He's got this beautiful body of work. You should...
Iggy Pop is 72. Speaking of bodies.
Just.
Anyway, moving on.
Speaking, yes. And I think of them often in the same thought.
Okay, let's talk about some documentaries now. First, a nature doc. It's brought to you by Disney. It's called Born in China. It tracks the lives of a mama and a baby panda, some baby monkeys, a mommy snow leopard and her cubs. And what did you think?
Well, I've been calling this a docutementary because the Disney, the Disney nature films. This is a series now, and I feel like I've seen five or six of them. They release one every Earth Day.
Yes,
and on a technical level, in terms of how they're made, they are stunning. I mean, they get gorgeous nature photography. You know, the cameramen and women, you know, are up to their hips in swamp water or snow or whatever it takes to get these amazing moments. But they are all so aggressively designed to keep four-year-olds entertained that they always contain this unctuous narration that gives all the animals names, gives them very sort of human anthropomorphic kind of motivations. And it gets in the way after a while. And you wish they would knock it off with the smarmy narration and just let the stuff unfold and maybe provide some facts. You know, I suggest seeing these movies with earbuds and, you know, listening to something else and just looking at them because they are visually something to behold.
They're beautiful to look at. Yeah.
The animals, but yeah. They're killers. Let's not forget.
Yeah,
and yeah,
circle of life.
They'll dial back a bit on when the snow leopard carries the sheep off to
baby,
the cave.
The baby lamb.
They don't really get into the details of that.
Like if this were a documentary about the baby lamb, it'd be like, here comes the big mean snow leopard. But it's actually a movie about the snow leopard.
The snow leopard must feed her children.
The snow leopard loves her precious cubs. So now she must go eat that superfluous little meat sack over there with legs. That's these films.
However,
and they're pretty cool. They're great for kids.
And Baby Panda is nigh irresistible.
Yeah, Baby Pandas.
Yeah,
you know.
Who doesn't love a Baby Panda? Yeah. Come on. Okay, well, speaking of eating, let's talk about Jeremiah Tower. He was one of the first celebrity chefs back in the 80s. There's a documentary about him. It's called Jeremiah Tower, The Last Magnificent. Here's a clip.
When there's something wonderful to be done, if you're not right there with me, then get out of the way.
Most people would not know who Jeremiah Tower is.
He was on the front of magazines. He was known all over Europe.
We hadn't seen his kind before.
He was a natural.
A superstar.
And this was a chef.
What is Jeremiah Tower's story? I'm sure most people have never heard of him.
Well, if you've heard of Chez Panisse in Berkeley, mm-hmm. famous restaurant run by Alice Waters, then you might also know Jeremiah Tower because he partnered with her in the early 70s. As the chef that helped her change
the way we all eat.
Fancy eating in the United States, yeah.
And, you know, the locally sourced fresh ingredients, that whole thing.
Yes.
And then what happened?
Then he and Alice Waters had a falling out, you know, overbilling, as famous people often do.
So much so that her absence in this documentary is conspicuous.
Huh. Yeah, they talked to, you know, Ruth Reichel and Martha Stewart and Anthony Bourdain and Mario Batali, a lot of food giants. But, Alice Waters was not reached for comment.
Archival footage.
Yes, we see her back in the day. Yeah. But then after that, he started his own restaurant called Stars, which was also legendary. And now he's sort of kind of famously off the grid. Like we see him in Mexico and he lives sort of remotely and by himself, and is a great raconteur, but obviously has taken himself sort of out of the rat race and out of this food revolution that he helped begin. But this movie, I think, goes a long way in sort of establishing his importance to where we are now. I had never heard of him, but I know who he is now.
And Alice Waters is pissed when she watches this.
Well, he basically accuses her of stealing all his ideas.
Kind of.
and of putting Chez Panisse on the map, you know, which there's a case to be made, I suppose, but I'm sure there's another documentary waiting out there that's all about Alice Waters and how she did it all.
Look,
so
every
we'll
chef,
let history decide.
Every chef is going to get their documentary.
Yes.
Yeah.
For patience.
Most of them have.
And
by
all
now,
of them will yeah. involve Anthony Bourdain in some
yes,
fashion.
Exactly. this is a lot of fun to watch. It's interesting. It's an interesting story. He's a fascinating guy. You get to hear from food writers and critics and, you know, other famous chefs. And if this is something you're interested in, and who doesn't like to eat and talk about food?
And watch a crazy story
and
watch crazy character.
Yeah. And this guy has had quite a life. Really extravagantly rich childhood, but really troubled his parents.
He's sort of boy Eloise.
Yeah. At one point, he shows up at dinner and his parents both look at each other and they say, I thought you shipped him off to boarding school. And the other one's like, no, I thought you did. You know, traumatic if you're the child in question.
But he grew up.
Was Catherine Heigl his mom?
Yeah.
when you grow up as a small child and you're always traveling first class and they're bringing you a cup of consomme on the Queen Mary, you will become a gourmand.
Okay. Well, and for the rest of us, we'll just eat popcorn, I guess.
There you go.
Right.
Dave White and Alonzo Duralde both write for The Wrap, both host the movie podcast Linoleum Knife. Check it out. Download it. Listen to it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye, you guys.
Bye.
Coming up, the locus of the violent protest movement in the Trump era, it's UC Berkeley. Well, that campus is bracing for more anger when Ann Coulter comes for a speech, maybe next week, maybe the following week. Anyway, sometime soon. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Conservative author Ann Coulter is not having it, which is not necessarily out of the ordinary. But the object of her ire is UC Berkeley, which is increasingly in the conservative crossfire. Coulter was supposed to give a speech at Berkeley next week, but campus authorities asked her to reschedule after admitting they didn't have the security to protect her. Here's what she had to say about that on Fox News.
You cannot impose arbitrary and harassing restrictions on the exercise of a constitutional right.
Berkeley canceled a speech from conservative provocateur Milo Yiannopoulos back in February after violent protests broke out on the campus. And just last weekend, 21 people were arrested when a pro-Trump rally was crashed by anarchists. Well, joining us now to talk about why Berkeley has become such a hotbed of political violence is Nanette Asimov, higher education reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle. Hi there.
Hey there.
All right. So first, what's happening with this Ann Coulter speech?
Well, it's been a pretty dramatic week back and forth between UC Berkeley and Ann Coulter. First, as you were saying, where UC Berkeley tried to cancel, saying they couldn't guarantee the safety, and then Ann Coulter saying, well, I'm coming anyway, and then Berkeley trying to accommodate her by giving her a date on May 2nd, which is smack in the middle of what UC Berkeley calls a dead week, which is the classes are canceled and students are studying, so nobody would really come. They fear. And now Ann Coulter's hired, and the student Republicans who invited her to speak have hired kind of a prominent San Francisco attorney, Harmeet Dillon. She's big in Republican politics. And they're giving UC Berkeley an ultimatum now. They have until 5 p.m. today to comply and let her speak next week in the evening as requested, or they will sue in federal court.
Wow. And so what does UC Berkeley say about all this?
Well, UC Berkeley hasn't given an extensive reply yet, but what they told me today is that they feel that they're on pretty solid ground in that they are trying to protect students' safety. They said that they have credible evidence, and they would not share precisely what it was, but they have credible evidence that there's been a threat of violence against Ann Coulter and participants, similar to that which shut down the Milo Yiannopoulos talk scheduled for February 1st, in which people infiltrating with masks and sort of clubs and things infiltrated a protest against Milo and caused $100,000 worth of damage on campus, breaking windows and setting things on fire. And I think UC Berkeley wants to avoid that happening again.
So are they admitting that the reason why they're scheduling it for, or they want to schedule it for the following week, is because it is so-called dead week and there will be fewer students around? Are they basically admitting that?
Nope, they're not.
Okay.
But they are what they say is that that's when they'll have some space for her, where they don't have what they call defensible space now. They've identified a place that would be free next week, but even that place, they say, is not free this week. And so they are not saying, you know, that that's why. They are sticking with the idea that it's too dangerous. And Ann Coulter's people and the attorney aren't buying that. She's got her own security contingent that will be coming with her, and they're just not. The attorney is not addressing the issue of violence. They seem to think that that's a non-issue, whereas Berkeley seems to think it's very much of an issue.
And plus, Berkeley is saying it's not going to be violent just for Ann Coulter. They're just not worried about her. They're worried about their students.
They are worried about their students. They on the Milo, there was a number of people, not a whole lot, but there were people who walked away with bloody faces and concussions. I think one guy famously took a bike lock and cracked somebody's head over that. And so, I mean, this was a legitimate riot.
Yeah.
And I was in the middle of it, and I saw people around me who were quite frightened. I was a bit frightened. But then things went crazy, and the violent protesters took to the streets after police evacuated the campus, and then they went around downtown Berkeley smashing bank windows and store windows. So it was not a pretty picture, and I think they want to do everything they can and feel that they're on solid legal ground to try and prevent the same thing from happening. But what the attorney for Ann Coulter and the students is saying is it's really not fair, because liberal speakers have recently been able to speak with no problem on the campus and been able to speak at night. That's one of the restrictions. UC Berkeley at any time does not want Ann Coulter speaking past 3:30 p.m., 3:30, depending. And that is because the rioters come out at night.
Yeah. So who are these rioters, and why do they keep showing up? We see these people in black. They're called the Black Bloc. Who are they, and what do they want?
Well, they're pretty secretive. I interviewed one at the Milo protest who, and that was pretty rare because they don't like the press, and he identified himself as Zombie, and he was wearing a black mask, and he said that he and others travel around. They go to Israel. They travel around the world, and we've certainly seen them in Washington recently and elsewhere. And they are part of what has come to be known as the Antifa movement, or anti-fascist movement, as they call it. People who are trying to, you know, shut down, if you will, Trump supporters, and certainly Ann Coulter fits into that, as does Yiannopoulos. So we don't know who they are, but at the press conference yesterday at UC Berkeley, UC Police Captain Alex Yao said very plainly that this is something that police all around the country really haven't seen before, and they're trying to figure out new ways of dealing with these well-coordinated, large groups of masked individuals.
Wow.
Yeah.
And it seems to be only happening. I mean, you say they were elsewhere, but we've seen so many in Berkeley. Is it just because of Berkeley's history?
Actually, UC Berkeley says this is the first time, or the Milo was the first time that they'd seen them there. So, yeah, they are focusing in on Berkeley now, but I believe it's since then, and it's because Berkeley really is the antithesis of what's going on in Washington and the political climate right now. Sometimes it's called the People's Republic of Berkeley, and so it really is a good ground zero for this clash of cultures and ideologies.
Okay, well, we'll see what happens come 5 p.m. Nanette Asimov, higher education reporter with the San Francisco Chronicle. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Julie Myers is in the studio for the very last time, ladies and germs, because she is leaving us. Yes, she is, to get a much, much better job. To go to NPR in Washington, where she will run the world. And we are going to miss her so much. We're going to miss you so much. I just want to say, you are anything but a superfluous meat sack.
Do you like me as much as you like Iggy Pop, though? That's what I want to know.
Well, you'll have to hit 70 first.
Okay, as long as I stay coastal elite, just the other coast is where I'm headed.
But I think people don't know that you are much more than the feedback person. You've been running this show. You came up with this music. You came up with our theme music.
All true.
Your proudest accomplishment, I think, is finding the husbands, as we call them.
They existed before we knew them, but as far as I'm concerned, the discovery is mine.
It's
I'm going to Columbus
yours.
Them.
Yes.
Yes, my favorite film critics, Dave and Alonzo. It's been a true pleasure, Madeline, working with you, working with the team here at KCRW. I'm going to miss all of you tremendously.
Well,
especially my feedback
you,
frequent flyers.
Sure. You know who you are.
You know who you are. You know who you are. Keep
you
the feedback coming.
You can still tweet at her.
You can still tweet at me. You can follow me at Julie Myers. I'm going to be headed over to the All Things Considered team, but my heart will be in Los Angeles. You'll still be hearing my stuff. We play All Things Considered here. You'll be hearing plenty from me.
We'll miss you deeply, and you've been amazing. And okay, pass the Kleenex, everyone.
All right, we got to bump some Iggy Pop after this.
Madeline Brand, have a great weekend, everyone.
Support for Press Play comes from the Kane Foundation, Rick and Suzanne Kane, and Jenny, Maggie, and Sari Kane.